We, therefore, the representatives of the United States of America, do, in the name and by authority of the good people of these colonies, solemnly publish and declare that these United Colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved.
Welcome to Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, a podcast commemorating the 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. The show is sponsored by the American Centrum in Hamburg, Germany, and I'm your host, Andrew Sola. We know that the Declaration of Independence happened on the 4th of July, 1776, but we often forget that the war for independence had been raging for a full 15 months before independence was formally declared. In fact, the first shots were fired between colonial militias and British regulars outside of Boston in the villages of Lexington and Concord on April 19, 1775. The reasons for the conflict are many, and we've been exploring the 27 grievances against King George in the Declaration of Independence throughout this series. Indeed, the final five grievances specifically reference the conduct of the war by the British from Lexington and Concord in April 1775 to July 1776. These are the grievances that complain about King George using privateers to plunder American shipping, sending foreign mercenaries to complete their works of death and destruction on the colonies, capturing American sailors and forcing them to fight for the Royal Navy, and lastly, inciting Native Americans to murder colonial Americans. And we might touch on some of those points later on. But the immediate cause of the outbreak of hostilities was something that all professional soldiers like to talk about: logistics. And here I recall the famous phrase, "Amateurs talk tactics, professionals study logistics." Specifically, the British Army, which numbered about 10,000 troops in North America at the time, was concerned that colonial militias were stockpiling weapons and gunpowder for a potential rebellion. So on the night of the 18th of April, 1775, 700 British troops left their headquarters in Boston in order to confiscate those supplies. Patriot intelligence found out about the operation, and Paul Revere rode out of Boston in the middle of the night to warn the Patriots that the British regulars were coming out. At daybreak on the 19th of April, the first shots were exchanged at Lexington. As the British operation continued to Concord, more and more militiamen arrived and engaged in harassing fire, eventually forcing the British to retreat back to Boston, where they were rescued by a group of reinforcements of about 1,000 British soldiers who escorted them back to their barracks. By the end of the day, the British Army suffered 174 wounded and 73 killed in action, and the Patriot militias suffered 39 wounded and 49 KIA. The impact of this day on British and American lives would be momentous. Imperial Britain was faced with a very imperial problem. What do we do with these British subjects who chose to embark on a violent and bloody revolution against the king and the state? And for the Continental Congress, they had to get their military in order. And they did. Shortly after the battles of Lexington and Concord, Congress authorized the formation of the Continental Army, with General George Washington in command, and the rest is history. I've outlined this first day of the war in some detail because today we're going to take a deep dive into military history and look at the first 15 months of the war, from Lexington and Concord to the Declaration of Independence, from a professional military perspective, from both the British and the American sides. So how did military commanders strategize this war that they had suddenly found themselves in? What were their assumptions at the start of the conflict? What were their concerns about logistics, intelligence, manpower, and communication? And how were they forced to adapt in the first stages of the conflict? We'll also look at lessons learned from both sides at the end of the conflict, and we'll take a look back from our perspective 250 years into the future. I'm delighted today to have with me two expert guests to help us answer those questions, Richard Dickey Sernberg and Seth Cannon. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hi, Andy.
Hi, Andy. Thanks for having us.
Lieutenant Colonel Dickie Sernberg is an infantry officer in the British Army. He has had a long and distinguished military career spanning deployments to a variety of locations, including Northern Ireland, Iraq, and Afghanistan. He is currently the British liaison officer to the Führungsakademie der Bundeswehr, which is the German Armed Forces Command and Staff College here in Hamburg. Lieutenant Colonel Seth M. Cannon is a command pilot in the U.S. Air Force. He, too, has had a long and distinguished military career, including deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan. He is currently both an exchange instructor on the Luftwaffe faculty and also the U.S. senior national representative at the Führungsakademie der Bundeswehr. So, just a quick disclaimer, both Seth and Dickie are appearing on this show in a private capacity. Their views do not represent the policies of the American or the British governments. And let's just now begin by me saying this. Although today we will be talking about the long and bloody war between our people, I think it's fantastic that we are sitting down together 250 years after the fact as friends and allies. For me, it's a reminder that all armed conflicts must come to an end. And another lesson is this. When given a little time for old wounds to heal, bitter enemies often become trusted and steadfast friends. But let's get started by thinking about some strategic assumptions at the start of the conflict. Dickie, you have a lot of experience with military planning, so let's start with you. What were the main lines of thinking for the British Army when hostilities began at the battles of Lexington and Concord on the 19th of April, 1775?
So I think at this point, before hostilities had really broken out, General Gage, the commander-in-chief of the British military and also the military governor of Massachusetts at that point, was very much assuming that the British were confronting a limited rebellion. They could deal with it through the rapid capture of the rebellion's ringleaders, removing the means that the rebels had of rebelling by capturing their arms and supplies. I suppose in terms of today's planning concepts, you would say that the military had identified that the enemy's or the adversary's center of gravity was their arms and ammunition and their ringleaders. And by attacking those, capturing those, they would remove from them the ability to continue the rebellion. I suppose, again, looking at modern concepts, we'd say sort of trying to take away the critical requirements that the adversary had that allowed them to be strong and to rebel. All very sensible military aims. I suppose most people could relate to that even now, but probably not activities that addressed the root cause of the problems that the colonists had with the British government. Gage was also relatively keen not to pitch, as he would see it at the time, Englishman against Englishman, and to try and reduce the tension that had built up over a number of years between the colonists and the British forces and the British government as much as possible. A relatively telling quotation from General Gage is that no blood has been shed under my command thus far, and I am determined none shall be. Clearly that didn't come to pass, as we'll see when we talk about the battles around Lexington and Concord.
I'll let Seth respond in a second, but I have one quick follow-up question. The way you're talking about this, I get the sense that the military commander, so Gage in the sense, kind of had a dual role. He's paying close attention to political realities and political tensions, but he has no kind of capacity to deal with that. He has a military, he has soldiers. So I'm just trying to get a sense of how General Gage, or the commander-in-chief in North America at the time, is kind of thinking about his own political responsibilities and how that's causing tension with his military responsibilities, because it seems almost like the general is a political leader as well as a military leader, and that, you know, is a tough dual task.
Yeah, and I think that's always going to be one of the big problems about senior command, which of course, okay, I'm not a senior commander, but I've seen the difficulties that senior commanders have balancing their responsibilities to the political leadership with the realities the military realities on the ground.
All right, Seth, how would you respond to this question? Basically, what is this fledgling military force? It's a militia force. The Continental Army hasn't quite been created yet, although it's created about a month or two after Lexington and Concord. What are people who are deciding to lead this potential new military force thinking?
Yeah. Well, I think both sides in this at the outset didn't see this as a revolution, so-called, or in a modern sense. Most colonial leaders believe they were defending traditional rights as British subjects rather than founding a new nation. That didn't come out until, you know, the start of 1776. And the conflict at that time was initially framed as a resistance to parliamentary overreach. As you stated, there was no American army or Continental army at the outset. And so before June of 1775, it was up to each colony maintaining militia forces, and there was no centralized command capable of conducting sustained operations. The Continental Army itself was essentially a wartime improvisation, especially once it became clear that this was no longer going to be an armed rebellion, but maybe a longer war, even if they hadn't kind of arrived at that mindset of independence yet. My sense is that many leaders believed militia forces might initially be sufficient for local defense. They were disabused of that notion after Lexington Concord, certainly after Bunker's Hill. And, you know, once Washington came on scene as the commander, he quickly saw the limitations of the militia system, you know, short enlistments, inconsistent training, and, you know, uncertainty of manpower going forward. And those are all things that they had to deal with. And I think initially, if there was going to be, I think the going-in assumption was that if there was going to be conflict, at least from the colonial side, it needed to appear defensive with the hope that them defending themselves and their rights as sovereign British citizens, that the political legitimacy of that would influence opinion both within the colonies, back in Britain, and abroad.
Dickey had mentioned that Gage was, you know, really concerned in avoiding Englishman-on-Englishman conflicts. And what we have is now a colonial militia, these militias who had fought with British regulars for decades in the Seven Years' War and afterwards. What are the colonial militias thinking about how they can fight against the British army, even in these early stages? And what is the British regular officer thinking about these harassing attacks happening to him?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think from the colonial side, I think the militia was part of the colonial political structure. You know, the militia system worked. There was that experience from the Seven Years' War as well as frontier warfare. I think the thing that did work initially, not so much that militias could stand and do field maneuvers against, you know, a British force, but one of the things that did go right was how quickly, especially during and after Lexington Concord, the number of militiamen that were able to assemble rapidly. But I don't get a sense that there was any kind of formulated strategy on how to fight the British. I think it became improvised and developed as this progressed within the first few months following Lexington and Concord.
Dickey, what's your sense of this?
So I think, and without straying into the detailed world of military history, because whilst I'm a professional soldier, I'm an amateur military historian. What you're seeing at this point in warfare is a beginning to move away from a position where massed ranks had to be used, but we haven't really got there yet. So most soldiers are still equipped with smoothbore muskets, and for your listeners, that effectively means the bullets are being fired aren't particularly well stabilized or aren't stabilized at all, have to be fired at relatively short range and in volleys to be effective. But in the years running up to the outbreak of the American Revolution, you're starting to see tactics evolve because the equipment that soldiers are being issued with, albeit in small numbers, allows those large massed groups to sort of disperse slightly. The majority of the British Army is still operating, though, in these massed ranks, but certainly in some of the previous engagements in the Americas, you had seen the development of what would come to be called light forces that operated less in this massed ranks and more as skirmishers. And I think particularly at Lexington and Concord, you see that type of tactic being used against the British as they withdraw back to Boston and are harassed on the way by the local militias.
Yeah, I might just add another point. The British troops are regular and know how to do all of these formal maneuvers on a set battlefield. They follow their officers' orders, they close ranks, they wheel, they do all of their marching things. And the militia obviously don't have that training or skill, but what they have been accustomed to is shooting from behind trees and running ahead and basically being harassing forces. But the other thing I note about the militias is they are indeed militias, so it's not like they are without training. They know how to shoot, which is kind of important, and many have rifles, not just muskets, which you know, obviously in a set-piece battle, the British have huge advantages, but in different types of engagements, some of those advantages are neutralized.
Yeah, totally concur with that assessment. Like I said, they were experienced with the frontier warfare. They did know how to shoot. They had some basic tenets of discipline, but as far as like unified command structures, a codified system of discipline, it depended on which colony that militia came from. A lot of the militia men elected their own officers, so that didn't necessarily lend itself to good order and discipline as we might consider it today.
Yeah, the election of one's officers probably isn't the most effective way of running a military. Let's think a little bit more about these objectives. Dickie, you said that it was pretty clear, even here at this operation that leads to the battles of Lexington and Concord, that Gage had some pretty clear military objectives. Let's make sure they don't have the weapons to fight, and let's capture their leaders. And I'm wondering to what extent Washington or these Patriot leaders kind of were aware of the objectives of their new enemy and therefore knew how to prevent that.
I think both sides were probably going to be pretty aware that weapons and supplies were going to be critical to be able to conduct warfare, to conduct rebellion, and that some kind of leadership driving the rebellion was also going to be critical. I think potentially one of the false assumptions that was made on the British side was that if you capture the small number of leaders that are driving this rebellion, then the rebellion will peter out and the loyalists will get the upper hand. And I think throughout certainly the early years of the revolution, there was always an assumption that there were considerably more loyalists than there actually were in reality, and that the intolerable acts and the problems that the colonists had with the way they were being dealt with by the British government were much more far-reaching, maybe, and much perceived as slights by a much greater proportion of the colonists than maybe was hoped for at the start of the conflict.
Interesting. Seth, did you have anything to add?
I think there was an expectation on at least the leaders in the Continental Congress that once the fighting began, that the undecided colonies would commit and that the resistance would spread. And that was partially true, but it was uneven. I also think that, talking about logistics, that colonial leaders believed that, you know, Britain was going to face enormous logistical challenges. And they're looking at what's going on in the world, even if not focusing on independence yet. It was obvious that Britain had imperial commitments that stretched their resources to all the other areas of the globe. And that distance, if it wasn't clear at Lexington Concord, certainly after Bunker's Hill, that this was going to be longer, that timing might favor the colonies as long as they can endure. And as you see, you know, from 75 into late 76, you know, American strategy increasingly became more about endurance rather than decisive victory.
You mentioned a number of points that we'll expand on now, because I just want to get a little bit ahead now of Lexington and Concord, because no one really won these first skirmishes. But as the British Army retreats back to Boston, all of these militias, and there is a great communication network that warns militias, keep building, and suddenly they surround Boston and kind of hemming the British regulars in. And that takes us to the Battle of Bunker's Hill and the Siege of Boston. Do either of you want to talk about sort of this next phase now? So, you know, this is happening really fast, even, you know, in modern terms. An operation is started, a British army leaves, and within like 36 hours, everything's crazy. You've got masses of militias forming. You've got a city under siege now. It's kind of hard to react to this. To me, it almost feels like it's happening as fast sometimes as modern warfare is happening. It's rapid developing stuff, even though in other respects, of course, things happened very slowly back then, communication and back to London, etc. So does someone want to talk a little bit about the British retreat to Boston, the Battle of Bunker's Hill, and the Siege of Boston? And of course, I know, Dickie, your old regiment actually fought there.
Yeah, see, for your listeners, some of them may know this already, but whilst we have the Royal Navy and the Royal Air Force, the British Army itself is not royal. That's principally because our identity tends to be held within the regiments and corps that make up the army. So we've got royal regiments, but not all regiments are royal. I joined what at the time was the 22nd Cheshire Regiment in the mid-90s. And that's an infantry regiment that can trace its heritage back to 1869 when it was initially formed. And in the early days, regiments took the name of their colonel. And then as a military bureaucracy built up, that was then changed to numbered infantry regiments. And the 22nd was the number allocated to my regiment. And there's a number of connections to the American Revolution. The first was that colonel of the regiment happened to be one, at the time of the Siege of Boston, happened to be one General Thomas Gage, who was clearly the commander there. Although the regiment itself was based in Ireland at the time, it then moved to the Americas in 1775 and got to Boston before the Battle of Bunker's Hill. It was certainly, according to the historical record of the 22nd, which I have in front of me, and which looks like it was published in 1849, so whilst not contemporaneous, not too far out, the regiment was engaged at the Battle of Bunker's Hill, and certainly the commanding officer, one Lieutenant Colonel James Abercrombie, was killed at that battle and was replaced by Major James Campbell, subsequently became Lieutenant Colonel James Campbell and commanded the regiment throughout the rest of their employment in the Americas. But effectively as I said before, I'm not a military historian, whilst I have an interest in it. And it probably doesn't surprise you to learn that the American Revolution is not hugely studied at places like Sandhurst. although partly that's because Sandhurst is a shorter course than maybe some military academies across the world, and therefore they've got to be pretty specific about what they study academically. But certainly in my reading into this, what you have is the British force has withdrawn from Concord, and Lexington got back to Boston under fire all the way, and you read out the pretty significant casualty statistics at the start of the podcast, and then finds itself in Boston surrounded by colonial militias. There were a number of attempts to break back out of the siege, to break the siege, none of which were particularly successful. But of course, it wasn't a full siege either, because the Royal Navy still controlled most of the ability to get into the city by sea. And therefore, it was always going to be unlikely that the militia were going to be able to starve or outweigh the British force that was stuck in Boston. And then you have a number of hills that overlook the city, one of them being Bunkers Hill and Breed's Hill next to it. And certainly my research into this for the podcast is that whilst the battle's called Bunkers Hill, a lot of the combat actually took place on the neighbouring Breed's Hill. And what effectively you have there is it is occupied by the colonial militia. The British then decide to clear them from that position, land on the 17th of June and commence fighting in what becomes one of the most costly battles for the British Army during that time, and I think historically as well in terms of numbers of killed and injured. And Seth earlier was talking about the militia felt they wouldn't be able to stand against massed ranks of professional British military, and the British military would also no doubt have made exactly the same assumption. There's always a real danger of professional militaries underestimating non-professional military forces. But Bunkers Hill appears to have been an occasion where the militia did stand against the British forces as formed bodies of men. The British win the day, clearly, albeit they don't really achieve what we would call operational effect from doing that. So a tactical low-level victory, which doesn't break the siege, which only clears the militia out of that area.
Seth, did you have anything to add?
Yeah, I think going back to the challenge, one of the biggest things was our supply lines. If the British had long supply lines, the Continental Army had thin supply lines. One of the early successes, and that'll play into our discussion progresses, was the seizure of Fort Ticonderoga in, I believe that was early May 1775 by Ethan Allen and Benedict Arnold. The cannons and other ordnance from Fort Ticonderoga will play a decisive part in what becomes the siege of Boston. Obviously, Bunker Hill was one of those attempts, you know, the militias, or I guess by this time, technically it would be the Continental Army. I think they had voted to create it. Washington's appointed commander-in-chief, and then 2 days later, Bunker Hill's happening. So Washington wasn't there, but they're fortifying Breed's and Bunker's Hill. And it's fascinating because, as Nicky said, it was a British tactical victory, but quite a Pyrrhic victory that everybody on the continent would see. I think it was something like 40% of the British attacking force was casualties. So a huge rate. So it was a strategic warning. So British forces captured the position, but they suffered something like nearly 1,000 casualties doing it. That immediately changed, obviously, the British perception of the conflict. And at the same time, the battle convinced colonial leaders that their forces could stand and fight regular troops under the right conditions. But psychologically, certainly, it hardened both sides to the reality that this was going to be a much longer conflict.
Can both of you comment just a little bit more about the perception at the time? I mean, we talk about it was a victory on the day, but not really a victory. Is that assessment just happening now from our perspective way in the future? Or do you think at the time, you know, the colonials were like, well, we caused a lot of casualties, but we still had to retreat. And the British were like, woohoo, we won. And then only later they're like, ooh, but lots of people died. There's this historical hindsight here. Dickie?
Yeah, I suspect so, because whilst at the time there were a lot of casualties, it will have been seen by the British, I suspect, as a victory. The effect of that victory took an amount of time to play out. They will potentially have seen that they've defeated the militias, they can go on and carry out further defeats against them, and therefore the war may well develop positively from that point. But over the next few months, clearly, when they remain stuck up in Boston until the British withdraw, it then subsequently becomes clear. And clearly, with the clarity of hindsight, we now look back and see what everything led to. But whilst I'm sure that General Gage was very aware of the casualties he had taken, he would also have been no doubt happy that really, for the first time in this conflict, there had been some kind of significant victory.
Seth?
Yeah, I think, obviously, 250 plus years later, there is a bit of that, but I think the facts of the case, as it were, rung true for the Americans. Almost 1,000 casualties, or maybe over 1,000 casualties on the British side, something over 400 casualties on the continental side. I think that one was a key battle and a strategic wake-up for the 13 colonies as a whole, even if all of them weren't necessarily convinced immediately. There is a great... I heard the quote, and I'm not going to do it justice, but I think Benjamin Franklin had a quote on or after the battle about doing the math of what it would take for the British Army to subjugate America by force. You know, if you, you know, take our wounded or killed at Bunker Hill, you look at the birth rate in the colony and run the calculus of how long it would take to actually kill every last one of us, and you see, you know, basically the math doesn't work out for Britain.
I might just add another person who actually witnessed this was Abigail Adams, took her son to witness the battle from across the water. And in her letter then to her husband, John Adams, the next day, she notes that what she believes she saw was basically the Declaration of Independence happening live, even though it would be another 15 months before the declaration was declared. And she was angry about that. She said she thought there, which is amazing, here you have a woman watching this battle unfold, but recognizing immediately, this basically is our Declaration of Independence. And she complained for the next 15 months that the other colonies wouldn't actually agree to sign the Declaration of Independence because she thought it had happened at that Battle of Bunker's Hill, which is just wonderful. And a reminder that we should always recognize that sometimes women have much more insight at the moment than men do. But that's another issue. Let's move on now and talk about the Siege of Boston and the eventual retreat of British forces from Boston. Dickie, why don't you carry on the story from here, please?
Yeah, so I think Seth mentioned earlier the capture of Fort Ticonderoga and particularly the capture of the heavy cannons that were there. Now, I'm not certain whether those were the only heavy cannons, but what the militia managed to achieve in early 1776 is that they managed to get these heavy cannons into a position where they could fire upon Boston. And it probably doesn't take anyone with a great deal of military understanding to realize what position that puts a defender in. If they're in a position where they're stopped up, they can't move, they can be fired at will by a weapon that you can't reach out and touch, then you are in a position that is effectively untenable. And again, my research into this was there was a little bit of Gage saying, we are going to withdraw, and if you don't let us withdraw, we're going to burn the city. But at that point, the die was really cast, and the British force had no real option other than to embark on raw naval vessels and to withdraw back up to Nova Scotia. Again, sort of going back to my historical record of the 22nd, it is mentioned relatively quietly what happened. General Sir William Howe assumed the command of the British troops in North America on General Gage returning to England in October 1775. In March 1776, Boston was vacated and the 22nd proceeded to Nova Scotia. So clearly, normally when things are not spoken about in any great detail, it probably means that it's not something you really want to speak very much about.
Seth, how do you think the Continental Army is beginning to process this?
Well, certainly during the Siege of Boston, this is when Washington is now forming the Continental Army during the siege. And so they're, you know, formalizing command structures, trying to formalize pay structures. They already recognize, I think early on, that the enlistment system is going to be untenable to a fight. Washington, in a letter to Congress to John Hancock, in I think his primary worry was not a defeat of the army, but that it's just disillusionment because the men walk away. But how are they processing it? They're digging in. I think with regards to the Siege of Boston and getting those cannon to Dorchester Heights, which ultimately led to the evacuation of Boston, that was a a real turning point in the siege. It wasn't a battle, it was logistics. And Henry Knox bringing something like roughly 60 cannon and other ordnance over 300 miles improvised through ice and snow over mountains to make that happen. And the British basically giving up the position without having to fire a shot or engage in battle. And I think this is also where you start to see through his staff or development, you know, Washington's strategic instinct to not try to pull the British out of Boston for a force-on-force fielded maneuver battle. He shows strategic constraint to keep them contained, wait for the guns, and go about it that way.
Yeah, and it seems that even at this point, as the British are leaving Boston and regrouping in Nova Scotia, everyone knows that this is nowhere near the end, right? They have a brief pause now where they can start getting their house more in order, but Britain has something called the Royal Navy and a huge imperial force that now has time to muster its strength and react. So I just want to take a pause right now. British now have retreated their force with the very powerful Royal Navy to Nova Scotia. For the time being, Boston is free. All of these military planners have time to plot their next steps. So, like, I kind of want to focus here now on what are we thinking? There's going to be this lull. There are minor skirmishes happening in the north, but basically the major British force is gone, and now we've got time to start preparing. So do either of you want to kind of discuss this sort of period of preparing for the next huge conflict? Dickie?
Yeah, so I think you mentioned that Britain had sort of massive colonial resources. I mean, I think one of the things that's probably really important to bring out, and certainly came out massively in when I was researching this, and it also plays to the history of the British Army. The British Army has always been relatively small, certainly in comparison to major European continental armies. We're an island, so the Royal Navy has always been the premier service, called the senior service, of the British Armed Forces, reflecting our location as an island and the fact that we had, at this time, significant interests overseas. So we had always been relatively reliant on this small army deployed overseas and militias and colonists acting with that army to build up the mass. So to say that we had large resources, yes, we did, but they were also employed in other parts of the empire and couldn't necessarily easily be brought across. Now, clearly, there were forces, British forces, being brought across to Nova Scotia, and we saw that forces had been brought into Boston as well. But the force levels were never massive, which probably sees a requirement to look elsewhere for forces that can assist. And of course, at the time, you've got a British royal family that's got links across into the continent of Europe, and that's where they look for reinforcement. And just linking back to the Battle of Bunker's Hill, I think one of the things that will have become very clear to General Gage at that point in time is that to fight and win in the Americas is going to require significantly greater force ratios for the British force than they had at that point in time. So that's one of the things that they're trying to achieve when they're in Nova Scotia, trying to be reinforced before carrying out further operations.
Seth, do you have anything you want to add to that?
Yeah. So the British are withdrawing. Washington is still training and formalizing the army and getting all of those structures you need, pay system, discipline, command structure, supply lines, at least trying to figure it out to lesser or greater success in either each one of those areas. The other thing that's happening this time is you do have an American army that has launched an invasion of Canada with the hope that you would convince the, you know, large French population up there with, you know, their antipathies and animosities following the Seven Years' War, you might have a 14th colony join in the fight. There's a whole nother British force up in Canada that's effectively, you know, removing the Continental Army out of there. So you've got the Quebec campaign with Arnold and General Montgomery, I believe. And, you know, eventually it peters out in front of Quebec. It's a defeat. And then they slowly withdraw at the start of 1776. So Washington's consolidating and training. You've got this other force getting essentially kicked out of Canada in this time.
Yeah, good. And so we're going to get to the next step here. After the British forces regroup, they focus on New York and New York City as the place where they're going to relaunch their campaign to subdue the colonies. But before we get there, Dickie, you were talking about the special status of the Navy because it is the most effective thing the British forces have. It's used in a really important way, and it's almost unique that, in fact, the Army at the time is so reliant on the Navy to do all the things that the Navy can do awesomely. It can move logistics and supplies fast. It can, you know, blockade ports. It can bombard cities and villages and towns. It can do all this great stuff. And that's sort of one of the big asymmetries at the time in global war, but specifically in this war too. The Royal Navy is unmatched, and certainly the fledgling Continental Navy has no way of dealing with this. So, Dickie, can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, see, I think I'm sure I'm going to be sort of eaten alive by a load of proper military historians. But but at this point in time, the Royal Navy was effectively the preeminent navy on the seas. The French trying to compete against it, clearly, as they did for decades after the American Revolution as well. So they were relatively free in their ability to move. Clearly, they were important for protecting a lot of the income that Britain at the time generated from its colonies, not just the colonies in America, and saw themselves as really the preeminent force in the world. But of course, one of the main problems with a navy, and potentially slightly different to an air force, is that it can only have a military effect where it can reach, which means that it's pretty limited to what we would now call the littoral, so where the land meets the sea, where it might be able to penetrate up into rivers, significant rivers, where there's enough draft to get ships in. And that's it. But it can't really do much in the hinterland, although it was clearly important for the British throughout their operations. And in my research, there was a point, and I'm sorry, the name eludes me, where the Royal Navy burnt, and I think it was during this period between Nova Scotia and New York, where they burnt a coastal town, a coastal port, which led directly to the authorization of the establishment of a continental navy, as well as a continental army, which then clearly generated at least a bit of a counterweight in the Americas against the Royal Navy.
Yeah. Something like 90% of Americans or colonists lived within like 100 miles of the coast at this time, if not more. But also in the hinterlands, there are some people. But as powerful as the Navy is, it can't act as that holding land force once you're out of reach of, say, the Navy's cannons. Then you do have to rely on a military, which has always been in British history smaller by numbers. And I kind of wonder if any American military planners kind of knew that and used that as a way of counteracting the British, knowing that, okay, well, we might have to cede the sea and the ports and some of the big rivers, but we don't have to cede anything else because they don't have that power reach beyond maybe a mile from the coast or a port. Seth?
I think that would certainly be a consideration. And as they progress, certainly after Bunker Hill, Boston, and a couple of the minor skirmishes, and as we will talk about as it develops, certainly the survival of the army and keeping the army in the field kept the revolution alive. So even if, you know, the British field forces that they were up against outnumbered them, they didn't necessarily have to give them battle every time, just stay in the field and stretch those logistics and lines of supply where they could just to outlast.
Dickie?
Yeah, I don't think we've covered this really, although we've potentially touched on it. The lines of communication for both sides were, as they always were in war at this point in time, were relatively stretched, difficult to secure. But the American militias were always operating from what we would call internal lines. It was easier for them to secure their lines of communication, their lines of supply. The UK, or Britain rather, could, with the Royal Navy, secure the lines across the sea relatively well. But throughout certainly this part of the conflict, they were always operating from outside of a port of supply, whether that was Boston initially, subsequently New York. And everything they did pushed out into effectively territory that was broadly controlled by the colonists with their militia, which causes problems in terms of security, because everything you do is observed, but also everything you do can be attacked, particularly behind your lines, which cuts off the fighting forces very, very easily. So that will always have been a problem that the British Army will have had to deal with throughout the campaign.
Right. And Dickie, the development of the independent colonial postal service is a totally untold story of this entire period. And I'll just recommend that everyone listen to the episode, which you haven't heard yet, but which I've recorded, on colonial infrastructure, which explains the importance of the developing postal service in allowing for this critical function of, you know, commanders being able to communicate each other, which becomes easier as the wars go on for the Continental Army. And it becomes more difficult as the British Army and the British postal ships start getting interdicted by American privateers and stuff, and these messages then get lost. Seth?
Yeah, I just to second what Dickie was saying. I think one of the things, just to, as a general comment on the whole of the conflict, was that the geography was beyond the scope of what the British field forces had dealt with in continental Europe before, as well as the fledgling Continental Army being composed of militias that a lot of times were operating well outside the territory which they formed.
All right, let's try to start bringing this part of the story to a close. We've mentioned that the British Army and the British Navy, British forces, are regrouping in Canada, getting ready to launch their offensive against the 13 colonies. And indeed, that happens in 1776 with the Battle of Long Island. And of course, the British capture New York City eventually. But all this is happening with the Declaration of Independence. So the British return to New York, to Long Island. On 4th of July, 1776, the Declaration of Independence happens. But just a few months later, a fairly major defeat happens for the new United States, which is the defeat of the Continental Army and the capture of New York City in 1776. So that's the quick story. Dickie and Seth, is there anything you want to mention about this phase of the conflict from a military point of view?
So you've seen some of the lessons learned from Boston in terms of, particularly in terms of force ratio, and you see that the British, having reorganized up in Nova Scotia, then moving on New York City. But again, you also immediately get into this position almost in a very similar way to Boston, where the British force manages to capture New York City, but then tries to push out and broadly fails to achieve very much other than capturing and holding a single town and some of its environs. And clearly that then plays out throughout the rest of the conflict. It's probably what today we'd try and call ink spot theory. But if you can't join up the ink spots that you own, you're not going to be able to win the conflict.
Seth?
Yeah, I mean, New York, both sides understood the strategic importance of New York. Hudson River Corridor connected New England to the rest of the colonies. And I think the British thinking at that time is basically, it's New England is still the problem, more so than the rest of the colonies. You defeat New England, the rest of them will come back into the fold. New York Harbor is excellent for the Royal Navy. And that's the strategic reasons there. It's also, I think, the largest expeditionary force the British Army had deployed in its history at that point. It's like something like 32,000 soldiers. So it's where the war, obviously at this juncture, you'd mentioned in a previous episode, January 1776, Thomas Paine writes Common Sense. We're now no longer fighting as subjects trying to reclaim rights. We are now fighting for independence. We have declared it. Now we're committed to making it a reality, we being the Continental Army and Americans then. And the New York campaign, where if Bunker Hill's the wake-up call of how long it's going to be, New York is the campaign where the war shifts from this obviously with the paper of the Declaration of Independence, it's no longer a colonial uprising, but it's for the British, a major imperial military operation and, a major defensive counteraction by the Continental Army.
What strikes me about this entire process in the first 15 months is all of the different developments happening in different ways, sort of the preparation for it. You have, as you mentioned, and I'm so happy you brought this in, Thomas Paine, the best-selling book, actually does a huge job in convincing a huge number of colonists, wait a second, maybe we should choose a side here. Because the vast majority of people, I think, as most people on the planet, typically would rather live in peace rather than go to war, as we know from the passage from the Declaration of Independence. People are happy to suffer abuses, right, for a long time until it gets to a point that they have to do something about it. And I think the militia history is so important. The Continental Army history that's developing is so important. Finally getting all of the colonies together to agree to a document. These are all different strands that are sort of forming together to lead to the Declaration of Independence, which is a triumphant thing. And it's celebrated in Boston with everything that refers to King George being collected and burned. And yet immediately after that, the British Empire says, oh yeah, here you go. We're just going to take one of your major cities and we're here. Now what are you going to do about it?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay. Anyone want to make a comment on that? Dickie.
So probably not a direct comment on that, but just, again, linking back into sort of the oddities of history and the 22nd Regiment of Foot, as I mentioned earlier, the colonel of the regiment was originally, well, not originally, but at the start of the revolution was General Gage. He handed over to a General O'Hara, who happened to be the man that surrendered Lord Cornwallis's force subsequently. But when I looked into General O'Hara, he was subsequently taken prisoner by the French in 1793 and imprisoned in Luxembourg prison, where he formed a very companionable relationship with a fellow prisoner, the Anglo-American revolutionary Thomas Paine. So I don't know whether that's something that you can link back through or not. Maybe not.
Yeah, well, no. I mean, I know about this. Thomas Paine's continuing agitation for rebellion and democracy made him a lot of enemies. And he was arrested after the French Revolution. And he wrote a lot of letters to Washington trying to demand that they, at Washington as president, get him released from French custody. And they wouldn't. That's one reason that Paine died a pauper in the States many years later. But yeah, that is a wonderful tidbit of history. Thank you. All right, so we're going to need to start wrapping this up, gentlemen. I want to make a quick comment about those grievances and then give you, actually, Dickie, I'll give you a chance to respond. I'll be speaking as an American here and you can respond to this. But in those last five grievances of the Declaration of Independence is the direct commentary by the Continental Congress about the conduct of war. I mean, we talk about reasons of war and war planning. I think most people forget that how you conduct yourself during war has always been really important. And one of the issues that we see mentioned a lot there in the Declaration of Independence, though it is, of course, a propaganda tract, is these five problems that the colonies have with the conduct of the war, which are using privateers, using foreign mercenaries, capturing, impressing American sailors and forcing them to fight with the Royal Navy, inciting Native Americans to murder Americans, and that's all put together and declaring the colonies no longer under his protection and waging war against us. So how do you look at that?
See, I suspect, Andy, that if I was in the position of a colonist at that point in time, and I was reading that declaration, I would be pretty angry myself. It's something that most of us can empathize with, I think. And of course, it shows a real danger that when you start using force against maybe part of what you believe is your rightful country possession, then you very quickly can, if you're not very judicious with the use of force, you can very quickly lose legitimacy by so doing.
Seth?
I think, like I said, those grievances were as much for the continental audience as it was for the wider audience. We're declaring intent with this Declaration of Independence and now keeping a fielded force to make it a reality. And, you know, these grievances were our rationale to not just the king and parliament, but to the rest of the world on why we were doing what we were doing.
I might also add, besides the mercenaries part, but certainly the Continental Army and Navy were doing their own fair share of plundering and privateering back at the British, and also capturing British sailors and having them fight for the Americans, which shows that oftentimes in war, a sort of what we might call war crimes are committed on all sides. Although I must say, remarkably, there are as many examples of respect between professional soldiers and sailors on each side, respect for the long history that the two peoples have had together. And even as the war is starting, people are already planning for the peace afterwards. But that's the subject of some other episodes. Gentlemen, we're coming to the end now, and I'm going to ask you for your takeaways from a military perspective as you look back at those first parts of the Revolutionary War. I'm going to start with 3 points. I've just been making some notes here. Talking to you has made 3 things a little bit clearer to me. One is the danger of underestimating irregular forces, which is maybe one of the first lessons that the British military learned. Okay, these aren't well-trained troops, but they have political will. And that made me think of, like, Ukraine, you know, a people that believes in defending their territory has some advantages that a foreign force, even though this wasn't technically a foreign force, doesn't have. The second thing that I was thinking about sort of from a modern perspective is the idea of that Royal Navy being this sort of unique force multiplier, can do all these things. And again, it made me think of the U.S. Air Force, which has some sort of unique capabilities that no one else has. The third thing, though, that I was thinking about was what you started with, Dickie, which is that the British military had 2 aims at the start of the war. That was making sure the rebels didn't have supplies, so the logistical thing, and also that they could decapitate the rebel movement, as we would say now, by capturing the leaders. But then it occurred to me that there was a third objective that they hadn't quite understood that ought to have been their third objective. It's that you can't hold land with the Navy. You just need more soldiers. You don't need more people to hold land. So that was sort of my third takeaway. So Seth, we'll start with you, but we'll let Dickie have the last word. Looking back 250 years, what are your big takeaways from looking once again at the founding of our country 250 years in the future?
Yeah, to put a pin on the New York thing, obviously a sound defeat and setback for the Continental Army, but the key thing there was that the army was preserved. And the revolution survived. Otherwise, it could have been over in 1776. But that same army that miraculously evacuated its position was the same army that attacked the Hessians on December 25th of 1776. And so keeping the military and the army alive is what kept the revolution alive. So other key takeaways, alliances matter, especially France in this case. Time, alliances, and legitimacy are force multipliers. You also had the Spanish and the Dutch declare war against England or get involved in conflict, not necessarily as allies with America, but it complicated the strategic calculus for the empire. Internal to the Continental Army, institution building wins wars. financing. That was an excellent episode, very interesting about money. Financing the revolution, the governance and command structures and logistic structures that needed to be built on the fly. The old adage that, you know, war is first political and military second, as the war played out. And lastly, that adaptation beats initial advantage.
All those points we can spend another half an hour talking about each. Wonderful takeaways. Dickie, I'll let you have the last word.
Yeah, I mean, I think Seth has effectively stolen most of my sandwiches with his summary. But I think what's really clear to me, looking into this sort of area of our shared history, that understandably Seth's much more attuned to and alive to than I am, is the fact that Britain at the time was focused more widely than just the Americas. That was not necessarily the only thing that was going on at the time. That we tried to potentially solve a political problem through military means, and without addressing the political reasons behind the rebellion, we were always going to struggle to defeat the rebellion itself. Seth mentions that keeping the army in the field maintained the revolution. I would suspect that even had it been destroyed subsequently after New York, that the problems would have just raised their head again in the future. And the distance that we were also trying to conduct our operations at made it extremely difficult, whereas the colonial forces, the continental forces, clearly were operating, as I said before, within their own backyard. My most important takeaway from this is that if you don't address the political causes of the problems, it's always going to be very, very difficult to address them through military means alone.
Dickie Sernberg, Seth Cannon, thank you very much.
Thanks for having us, Andy. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thanks, Andy.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, why don't you visit us at our website, americancentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The American Centrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the American Centrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americancentrum.de. Thanks for listening.